In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 414. We're joined today by Austin Peterson, who is editor of The Libertarian Republic, which you can visit at thelibertarianrepublic.com. It's a free market news magazine featuring the writings of prominent libertarians, conservatives, independents, and sometimes Democrats. Austin is the former director of production at FreedomWorks and was an associate producer for Judge Andrew Napolitano's show, Freedom Watch, on the Fox Business Network. Before I turn to my conversation with Austin, which is going to be quite long, I don't want to lose what's coming up later this week, so let me just tell you. Tomorrow we're going to talk to Ray McGovern, CIA veteran, on the surge worked theme. Did the surge really work? What happened during the surge? This is the conventional wisdom everyone believes in. Well, the surge worked. The war was a terrible idea, but the surge worked. Did it really? So we'll talk to Ray McGovern about that. Then Wednesday, we're going to talk about Uber and other technologies that are getting around the state in clever ways. Thursday, Bob Murphy returns to the show to talk about three wrongs don't make a right. We're talking about three major ways in which Paul Krugman, who says the Keynesians have been right about everything, has been astonishingly wrong. Then finally on Friday, Patrick Newman joins us to talk about an area in which the historians got things wrong, namely the Depression of the 1870s. We're going to take a revisionist Austrian look at the Depression of the 1870s on Friday. Patrick is a PhD student at George Mason University and the author of a very important academic journal article on that subject. Finally, make sure and get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, by texting the word LIBERTY to 33444. That is a fun book, and it's a full-length book, and it'll give you a lot of ammunition you can use. And, of course, you'll also get my weekly little letter, which if you hate it, you can throw it away and never get it again, but you get that free ebook by texting LIBERTY to 33444. And now, Austin Peterson. Austin, thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom. Good to hear from you.
You have become rather a controversial figure in libertarian circles. I guess I first got to know you when you were the producer of Freedom Watch, the show we all loved with the great Judge Andrew Napolitano. And then, of course, you know, he doesn't have that show anymore, but you more than bounced back from that. You've had quite a bit of success, and you have this website that's fairly heavily trafficked, thelibertarianrepublic.com. I was just telling people about. Let's just start there. Tell me what the Libertarian Republic is all about.
Right. So it's sort of a cultural play. I always thought that libertarian ideas deserve to sort of stand up to the marketplace that we all like to discuss. And certainly there are some for-profit models out there that exist, you know, such as yourself, libertarians who are putting their ideas to the test of the marketplace. You know, I think I've always read Reason Magazine and I really enjoyed it. But I always thought, hey, there's a big bureaucracy behind this and they're a nonprofit, which sort of, you know, shields them from the marketplace. So I wondered if there wasn't room in the market for a cultural libertarian website that had a focus on issues that have a libertarian base to them, but that would appeal to a mainstream audience. So that, because what I learned, Tom, by working at Fox was that the best way to sort of to get your message out was to tap into the zeitgeist of what people are already talking about and not try and force your message down people's throats directly, but to try and find the things that are already interesting to them, find the libertarian theme in the story, and then sort of widen people's knowledge by talking about what they want to talk about, but by inserting the libertarian narrative in it so that when national news is breaking, we actually have a voice in the debate, and that people, instead of being siphoned off to something like, you know, the Brookings Institute or maybe some other left-wing think tank or what have you, that there would be an institution that exists to siphon people off to your website, for example. You know, we recently featured you as having one of the top 10 best, you know, one of the top 10 libertarian best libertarian websites. And so I wanted something to exist that was, you know, sort of funneling people who are already interested in certain topics towards our ideas and giving them sort of introductories, primers to our ideas so that they, you know, so that more people can be interested in it. And so far it's been fairly successful.
Well, no doubt about that. And as you know, it is hard to start a new website in, you know, 2014, 15, because people's habits are already formed online. They've already got their dozen websites that they check, you know, the 10 websites. And now you're asking them to look at a different one, and which usually means they have to drop one of the ones they're looking at already. And you've got a, you know, an impressive Alexa rank. I mean, you've somehow done it, and it is, and you've made it look easy, but it is not easy. I can testify that is not easy to do.
It's not. It certainly isn't, Tom. I've faced a lot of challenges. There's been a lot of ups and downs. If you actually look at my Alexa rank over the last 3 years, you'll see there was like a cavernous drop when Facebook changed their algorithm so that we sort of dropped.
Oh, don't get me started on that Facebook algorithm.
Yeah, it was horrifying. I spent the last part of last year thinking I'm ruined. It's over. I tried to run a business. I failed until this January when I finally said to myself, listen, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. It's time to change strategy and get more aggressive and find ways to spread our message in ways that are even more entertaining to people. You know, and that's how people like Glenn Beck got success. I mean, they found ways to talk about the news that people already cared about, and they inserted their own narrative in it. And so I think that, you know, that now I've sort of proved that there is a sort of pop culture niche that can be served. And I think, you know, some of my competitors and things like that, like they offer similar products. But what the Libertarian Republic offers is a little bit more of the diverse spectrum of libertarian thought. It's not, you know, paleoconservative, although there are some paleocons. It's not, you know, atheist skeptics like myself. It's not all that. We have a faith and freedom section. And actually, one of my writers right now sitting across from me, she's writing an article about how Jesus, you know, the most libertarian quotes from Jesus. And I wanted to create a place where people could come in from all the different spectrum of libertarian thoughts, because libertarians have such a diverse variety of beliefs, as you well know, and I'm sure we're going to discuss here. But I wanted to sort of have a little place where everybody could come in and sort of discuss the issues of the day and find what we're all libertarian about and see if we couldn't find common ground in order to strengthen and solidify the movement. Now, that sometimes means that you talk about divisive things or that you disagree strongly. But, you know, if our ideas are good and strong and true and right, then they deserve to stand up to scrutiny and even to sometimes be called into question in order for us to harden our arguments for when we go up against our real enemies, the neocons, the social democrats, the big government status, the ones who really wanted to, you know, to fight us and stop our momentum. Then we need to have good, strong arguments in order to take the fight to them in a much more efficient manner.
Now, if you're going to say that it's perfectly all right for libertarians to argue among themselves, to thereby hone their arguments, you're not going to get any argument from me. You'll get no stronger supporter than I am. But because I do that too, there are times when I feel compelled to respond strongly to something that another libertarian has said. It's not something I do all the time. It's not even something I do even part of the time. I do it once in a great while, but when I do it, I do it with gusto, because if I've been forced into doing it, then it must be something that's really really egregious. However, let me point out something that I read on the Libertarian Republic, and I realize that as the editor, you are not strictly responsible for or necessarily in agreement with every single word that's on the site. And of course, you couldn't be based on the way you just described the site. But at the same time, how helpful is it in encouraging the exchange of ideas and the honing of arguments to say something like, anarcho-capitalism is stupid, delusional, crypto-leftist garbage? Is that the kind of culture you're trying to foster?
Yeah, I think that it's important that those who have who see libertarianism as a religion are strongly questioned. And I think that sometimes in doing so, the only way to do that is to follow the tactics that I learned from one of our biggest enemies, which is Saul Alinsky. And I've read The Rules for Radicals, and I actually agree very, very vehemently with Saul Alinsky's strategies that the quickest way to get an opponent's attention is to infuriate him. And that happens very, very easily with libertarians. They seem to be very easily angered. And I myself am actually not very easily angered. And so I think that, one of the big problems that we have are with hotheads in our movement. And, sometimes I poke the bear. I think that that's perfectly a legitimate strategy to poke at people who I think are a bit too dogmatic or perhaps too religious with their views. While I didn't write that piece, I tend to agree with it. I think that anarcho-capitalism is kind of stupid, Tom. And I would say that happily to anyone to their face and see if they could challenge me to a debate on this. And I'm more than happy to discuss that with you. But, these kinds of arguments were the same. If you look at the founding fathers, for example, when they were having debates with one another, they certainly weren't as civil as a lot of people like to think. What was it? I mean, didn't Thomas Jefferson call John Adams bald, fat, stupid, and in turn he was called like an adulterous lech? It's not as if this is unprecedented whatsoever or that it isn't effective, because negative attack ads, they certainly are effective, Tom. And to me, it's not necessarily the type of attack that's important as much as it is the ideology behind it.
Related to this, related to anarcho-capitalism, very strongly, is the idea of the non-aggression principle. And it's been increasingly, well, I don't mean to disparage the movement by calling it fashionable, but let's face it, it has become increasingly fashionable among some libertarian philosophers to claim that they want to dispense with the non-aggression principle. This is not a helpful way of thinking about things. They want to think about things differently. I find that the non-aggression principle is extremely helpful because it helps clarify exactly what rights we have. It makes the idea of rights easier to pinpoint so that we know, so we're not fuzzy. One thing I can't stand is fuzzy thinking. I want precise thinking. If we're going to talk about rights, I want to know exactly what they are, and the non-aggression principle helps me to clarify exactly what rights people have and what rights they don't have. Now, what is your objection to it? Why do you think it's obscuring the search for truth here?
I just think it's childish, Tom, and the idea that you can have a clarity in rights theory, I think, flies in the face of reality when you look at the Constitution and the issues that the Founding Fathers fought over, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. They knew that there was no way that they could that the rights that of man were innumerable. And if you wanted clarity in those rights, why not write them down? So if you think that you could have clarity in those rights, then certainly there must be some way to codify them. But if not, then those rights they tend to be a bit fuzzy. And I think that the non-aggression principle on its face is childish and wrong. It's totally wrong to center libertarian philosophy on it, because who gets to define what is aggression? And of course, if you look at what most anarchists would say, if someone points a gun at you, for example, you can shoot them before they shoot you. That's aggression. But if North Korea points a nuclear weapon at Los Angeles, all of a sudden we have to wait until that it seems like it's a credible threat. I think that if you really want clarity of thought, Tom, you must abandon the non-aggression principle as a centerpiece of libertarian thought, because it does not provide a consistent theory. If you want consistency, the non-aggression principle will not provide it to you, because no one can agree on what constitutes aggression, and so it gets muddy. Just like if you took someone up in a balloon, right, in a hot air balloon, and you're both in there, and you own the hot air balloon, and you wanted to get that person out of your private property, would you have a right to just kick them out of the balloon? Maybe you would if you had a full hardcore anarcho-capitalist view of things, but I might see that as aggression. So I think that unfortunately the world is not consistent, Tom, and so we have to sort of look at things as they lie, not as we want them to be. And yes, that does mean that that things tend to be fuzzy, but the world is fuzzy, and I think we sort of have to accept that sometimes and to try and find the things where we can agree, where we can solidify things. But by adopting some sort of non-aggression principle, I think it muddies the water too much. It's wide open and open to interpretation. It's not the clarification that you say that you want.
All right. Well, I think this conversation should be let's make this more of a conversation than an interview. I mean, that's usually how I do the show. I don't have like some canned questions, sure. And then I the person answers, then I ask another question. I would much rather just have a conversation. So I hope you don't mind if I spend a little time spinning this out, and then you give your response and so on and so forth. All right. Well, first of all, the idea of being in a balloon or being in an airplane, like I take you up in my plane. I mean, Austin, do you think if I took you up in my plane at 30,000 feet, I would say, Austin, all right, I got you right where I want you. It's my plane. Here's the trap door. I mean, do you really feel like I would be a consistent libertarian in doing that? The idea is that if I'm the one who puts you in a vulnerable position, then I have then taken on some responsibility for you. I'm the one who did this to you. I can't then say, oh, by the way, you have to get off my property. So that the balloon and airplane thing has more or less been taken care of. Now, just because people don't agree, there is a huge diversity of opinion out there with regard to rights. There are all different kinds of rights theories. There are all different theories of justice out there. The Marxists have a theory of justice, as perverse as it is, they have one. A criminal has a theory of justice, which is that I should have your stuff and you shouldn't. Like, everybody has at least an implicit theory of justice, but the mere diversity of these theories doesn't mean that there can't be a correct theory. And even though we happen to think that ours is correct and we happen to be very much a small minority, I don't think I'm just being pig-headed by insisting that my particular one happens to be correct.
Well, I don't think you're pigheaded enough, to be quite honest, Tom, because I think that in reality, if you believe that the non-aggression principle should be the centerpiece of libertarianism, then those ideas should be enforced. I think the problem that I have with anarchists is that they don't believe that their ideas of property rights should be enforced. In other words, there's no central definition of private property. I am for a single central unified top-down definition of private property, that my justly acquired private property is my justly private private property and yours is yours, and that there should be no other accepted definition of private property or and natural rights. I mean, you should definitely be pigheaded about that kind of a thing, but my problem is that in an anarcho-capitalist utopia, that there is no way to enforce contracts. And that the way that contract enforcement that anarchists describe is, to me, it's insufficient for actually proscribing those beliefs that you claim to believe in. In other words, if these rights are right, then they should be enforced.
All right. Well, I have no problem with saying that they should be enforced. But in the same way that you say in anarcho-capitalism, you can't have enforcement because there isn't, I guess, a single institution doing the enforcing, because there is no monopoly institution?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, like, I think a monopoly institution is often plagued with bureaucratic and problems, as you and I see. But the idea is that whatever institutions would enforce private contracts, whether there be one or whether there be many, and as you know, there actually are multiple states. There are hundreds of states in the world that have competing systems. It just so happens that we live in the United States and there are 50 competing states in there. So we do have a bit of a laboratory there for competition. But that we do have a sort of a single definition of a First Amendment right, for example. And I think that the codification of some of these principles is absolutely correct, and that in order for us to enforce these natural rights that you and I believe in, that there does need to be a monopoly authority and such things. And here's my question. I mean, look at something, for example, like Ron Paul's speech to Congress after the 9/11 attacks. Surely you're familiar when he called for letters of mark and reprisal. Well, yeah. even such letters of mark and reprisal were to be done by what? The monopoly of the state, the government. Ron Paul was calling for letters of mark and reprisal that the government would hire mercenaries to go after Osama bin Laden. Now, certainly I would have much thought that that was a much better solution and it would have been constitutional, but it's still statist, Tom. And because it relied on the monopoly of force of the government through the taxation process for us to be taxed in order to provide for our national security. So, I mean, do you disagree with Congressman Ron Paul's approach of mark and reprisal and using a monopoly on force in order to tax us, in order to go after Osama bin Laden, or would you have rather had some sort of competing private agency do it?
I happen to think it would have been fairly easy to put a bounty on his head and have him killed very quickly. I don't think that would have been hard at all.
But who pays?
I think I could have easily have done that.
Who pays?
But hold on. I want to talk about rights. I want to stick to one issue because otherwise we'll be all over the place.
Sure.
You have a piece that you wrote. I'll link to it on the show notes page today, which would be tomwoods.com/414. I think it's called Five Reasons I'm Not an Anarchist. And you say that you used to be an anarchist. You used to be an anarcho-capitalist, but then you thought about it further and you came to these conclusions. Now, the conclusions you've drawn are ones that are addressed in the literature. So I don't know why they convinced you at one point and didn't convince you later, but you're perfectly at liberty to change your mind. But one of the points you make is that people have a natural right to be legally represented in court. And my question about that is not whether it's desirable for people to be represented in court, but what you said in the article is that for the sake of a society based on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we need people to have a right like that.
That's correct.
But given that that right, so-called, does involve forcing other people to do things— Right? I mean, what if I'm a lawyer? I'm the only lawyer in society. I would be obligated to defend you even if I don't want to. Then that makes, at least my view is all you have are negative rights. You have no positive rights. That is to say, you don't really have a right to life. You have a right not to be killed. Like, you don't have a right to a kidney dialysis machine. How could you? How could that be a natural right? There weren't kidney dialysis machines 500 years ago. And on a desert island with two people, how would I enforce my right to a kidney dialysis machine if not by enslaving the other person? So that can't be a natural right. So it's easy for me in my system to know what rights are. Whereas given that you are willing to admit the possibility that people can in fact enforce a right that would involve forcing other people to do things for them because you say this fosters a society based on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's so vague and so imprecise that why wouldn't there be a right to food? Isn't a right to food much more important than a right to a defense attorney?
No, and you know what? Let me use another intangible example of a right. What do you think about the right to be safe from double jeopardy, for example? Double jeopardy is the type of thing that is a right that doesn't require any sort. It's not like a food right. It's not an actual substantive right. You don't have to pull anything out of anywhere or take resources from anyone. But the right to be secure from double jeopardy is a right that it's sort of in the mushy middle between a negative right and a positive right. So if we have competing legal systems and we live in an anarcho-capitalist utopia, there's nothing to stop. There's no force or counterbalance that would stop someone from putting me in a situation where they could just sue me or try and use their private defense firm or their private court to sue me out of existence. And while we're there, there's nothing to demand that the person who is suing me out of existence provides me with some form of representation if I'm not able to afford it. And certainly that representation, even if there was a requirement that he provided it, well, guess, you know, you take the king's coin, you sing the king's song. So that person, if that lawyer even were to be demanded, or even let's say it was offered voluntarily, you wouldn't want that lawyer. You wouldn't want to have that person working for you who was not working on your behalf. So I think that, you know, there is a problem that some of these rights are hazy, that you're, and you are correct that it is not as precise as we would like it to be. But, you know, like I say, the world is imprecise. And unfortunately, we have to deal with things as they lie. So when it comes to the world of negative rights and positive rights, I think there certainly are some positive rights. And I know that that's exactly what makes me not an anarchist. And some of those positive rights include the right to have some form of representation if you are accused of a crime. And so the only way that we could sort of provide that would be to have some sort of central authority on it. It doesn't have to be a monopolistic, you know, all one size fits all authority. But the problem with anarchism is that it does not provide for civil rights. It does not provide for the type of liberties that we as Americans enjoy under our constitutional system.
All right, let me jump in here, because the kind of argument you're making is the kind of argument that the left will then turn around and use against our whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll say, if you are conceding that it is not even conceivable to you how in a purely voluntary society this problem might be resolved. If you can't even conceive of that, well, we can't conceive of how food, which is far more fundamental could possibly be delivered without a central authority. Without, so they would say, look, under minarchism, we can't guarantee that people are going to have food, and that's a terrible thing. I mean, without food, you don't have anything to worry about with lawyers or not lawyers because you'll be dead. So we need to have a central authority distributing food. And yes, there are some positive rights like the right to food. On what grounds can you stand up to them and tell them they're wrong?
Oh, absolutely. Well, here's the thing. I actually do believe there is a positive right to food, and that positive right exists for children. And I my flirtations with anarchism ended the day that I read Murray Rothbard's article about the rights of children, and that that children do not have a right to be fed or to be cared for. But my argument, my disagreement with Rothbard, of course, is that by having a child, you are in effect having a basically agreeing to an unwritten contract, and that's this is why I get angry with anarchists, and I think that the philosophy is stupid because they say, well, I didn't sign the social contract of the Constitution. Yeah, well, I didn't agree to the non-aggression principle. But when it comes to the rights of children, this is the perfect story. The number one biggest, most popular article in the Libertarian Republic's history was a little-known story called Baby Nearly Starved to Death by Lazy Parents. And the anarchists jumped in saying that the parents have absolutely zero obligation to provide that child with subsistence or to take care of them whatsoever. And then, of course, we get to the prom night dumpster baby argument. And I found myself in shock that the anarchists would actually be arguing that a parent has a right to leave a child in a dumpster and that is not an act of aggression. It's stupid. It's wrong. And I think it's actually fairly evil, Tom. So, yes, I do think there are some minimal positive rights, and those obligations should be held out for children who cannot fend for themselves, and that is our obligation as a society.
Okay. I want to jump into the children thing because I agree with you on that. I don't agree with the Rothbard analysis of that. And there has been...
Uh-oh, Tom, you're in trouble.
No, but I'm not because, I mean, my listeners are not cultists. I think this is a real libel on libertarians and on anarcho-capitalists because, I read a lot of this literature. I watch a lot of YouTubes, and I know that people call each other names, and we lose our temper over stuff like this. I lose my temper over some things, not this, because I feel like if we ever got to a point in society where we really were faced with the choice between private police and government monopoly police, I would be so deliriously happy. I don't think I'd even care anymore. You know, so I don't get that worked up about this, but. I do.
So is there a positive right? Is there a positive obligation? Is there a positive right of children, of babies, to be fed and cared for?
I don't think the term positive rights, but it's the same thinking. But it's the same thinking as putting you up in a balloon. If I send you up in my airplane or something, I'm the one who put you in the vulnerable position.
So there's no contract, there's no nothing.
If I've put you in a vulnerable position, then I have a responsibility for you because you are in my hands. And the same thing is true of a child or anybody. I mean, if you happen to be passing through, let's say you got lost and I let you sleep over in my house. The fact that you're in my house doesn't mean I can start harvesting your organs. I mean, you are in my care, and because you're in my care, and as again with a child, I put you in the vulnerable position. You don't have to be a minarchist to say, therefore, there is a moral obligation that comes from putting somebody in a position of vulnerability. Now, hold on a minute, because I'm afraid I don't want to get completely sidetracked. I do want you to know there are people though who have written on the issue of children who have. For example, there's a debate that's gone on for years because Walter Block never lets a debate end, ever. He is going to finish that debate until he drops dead. So if you write a reply to Walter, he is going to publish a reply to your reply, and it goes on forever. But my friend Jakub Wisniewski in London has written some very, very good material on children and the obligations that parents have toward children, and he is an anarchist. So if that's your only reason— then that's not a good enough reason. But I know that's not your only reason. My point is, leave aside the special case of children, because that's not primarily what progressives are talking about. They're talking about all human beings. If all human beings have a natural right to have the government expropriate somebody to give them legal representation, well, again, why wouldn't they have the same right to get free food? And if they have the right for free food, why not medical care? I mean, you're going to let these people die? You're going to let these people die because you have no guarantee in your system that everybody's going to get medical care. You can't guarantee that in the same way that I allegedly can't guarantee that contracts will be enforced.
Right, right. Well, so the question here is that who pays, obviously? Like, who pays for that legal representation? I mean, there are some people who really would prefer this anarchist system simply for the fact that they could destroy their enemies and they wouldn't be required in any sense to provide them with the ability to defend themselves. I mean, I'm not trying to say, hey, the warlords are going to take over here. But when you're talking about the violating other people's natural rights, I do happen to believe that you have a right to be neutrally represented if accused of a crime. So I guess my question to you is, Tom, I mean, what rights does anyone have to be safe and secure, to have their natural rights secured from others? I understand the mechanisms that anarchists have described, but I mean, are you telling me seriously that you think that someone should be able to just be endlessly accused of crimes by a neighbor or neighbors, and that a tyrannical majority in their hometown?
No.
Could, okay, so then what sort of mechanisms of defense does an individual have against any larger corporation, whether it be government or whether it be private? What sort of defense does any individual have against that sort of tyranny? Because there would be tyranny in anarchy. I guarantee you, Tom, there would be tyranny.
Well, okay, first of all, there's no denying that there's no system that yields you no problems. But the question is, how can we minimize the problems?
Right.
How can we try to put a boundary around the problems to the extent possible? Now, these legal protections that you're talking about, a lot of them evolved very gradually over time in a system that was highly decentralized. A lot of the legal principles that we take absolutely for granted emerged in the highly decentralized common law system.
Right.
And
but
it did not
law.
Emerge for
it's still
but,
law, Tom. It's
I mean,
still
but,
law.
But I'm not opposed to law. Why would I be opposed to law? The point is, these principles evolved not top down. They evolved one case at a time, and eventually principles bubble up from this gradual process. But I mean, we're surrounded all the time by a system that at least we can sort of approximate what things would be like by the fact that in the United States there is a tremendously flourishing and successful industry of private arbitration. Now, why would people want to go to private arbitration? Isn't there a possibility that in private arbitration they would be able to be harassed for the rest of their lives and they would get unjust decisions and it would take 15 years? Oh, wait, that doesn't happen. And in fact, in terms of a case taking 15 years, I'd say it's the monopoly system that bankrupts you. It takes forever.
Yes.
Your case never gets heard. The celebrity gets off. The poor guy goes to jail. That's the system you say would originate under anarchy, but that's what we have now.
No, well, sort of. But here's the thing, Tom. You're not going to minarchists don't ban competing systems. I mean, the minarchist simply says that whatever mechanisms of enforcement would arise, it would necessarily be called a government. I mean, to me, the problem with anarchism is that it replaces government with governments that you don't call government. So the idea behind minarchism is simply that there will be some mechanism of enforcement, and that mechanism of enforcement, whatever it should be dedicated solely to protecting the individual, the natural rights of individuals. So, I mean, again, it's a bit of a red herring to assume that I'm demanding monopoly control on the legal system, that just simply that a legal system should exist that provides for these natural rights, and that if people desire to go outside of it, to secede from that system even, then they should have the right to do so. And in a sense, we do sort of have that, you know, in the United States. You can secede, you can leave from one state to another, you can go, you know, if you don't like the laws of California, you can go to Maine or what have you. So there is a sort of a beautiful federalist system here. I guess what I'd like to ask you, Tom, and what I would really love to have you answer for your audience is, because it's very common to hear from anarcho-capitalists, they make the joke, of course, that the same Lysander Spooner, they post the Lysander Spooner meme, you know, that the social contract I didn't sign, you know, the four-letter word. So I guess my question to you is, does every contract that someone has to agree to be signed? And if so, what does that imply? What does that mean?
All right, well, not everything has to be signed, because not everything, for example, Bob Murphy gives the common example of, you go into a restaurant, you sit down. It's everybody understands that anything you order has got to be paid for. You don't sign a contract when you walk in there, but we all understand, and that it's customary to leave a tip for good service. I mean, it would be absurd to feel that you need to do that for something so trivial. But when you get to something that is of the greatest significance, that is, I mean, when you, in our society, if you buy a car or you buy a house, you engage in any major purchase, you are signing contracts that, I mean, you don't even know what you're signing half the time. You're signing so many contracts and you're filing them in triplicate, and there are all these rules for what to do. But this alleged social contract says that simply because I'm standing in some particular standing room, I have consented to have at least one-third of my income taken from me in perpetuity, that I have consented to have my physical body called into service for the state's wars, that I have consented to a whole raft of rules. Well, but there's no attempt to actually get my consent. There's no actual in that case, is ludicrous. Like, there is no defending the social contract. That is leftism, pure and simple.
I mean,
if you want to defend government, defend it on some other grounds. But the social contract is the worst argument you have.
I'm not. But the problem is that the non-aggression principle is one of those sort of unsigned agreements that you would have. I won't call it a contract, because certainly
because it doesn't obligate you to provide anything for anybody.
Well, that's why it falls apart, and that's why we should abandon it, because it places absolutely zero obligations on any of us to abide by it.
Go ahead.
One of the things that people, that anarchists like to say is that you want a state because you can't control your impulses. And they say, well, yeah, I won't kill someone, but maybe you will, right? So maybe they like to say, oh, Austin, you just want the state so you can hold you back from doing violence. And in a sense, I used to say, oh, no, I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to break the law, stuff like that. But then, you know what? I realized that was actually incorrect. I actually do want to break the law, and I actually do want to kill someone. There's one person that I would love to kill, and his name is Robert Courtney. He's a pharmacist in Kansas City who was diluting chemotherapy drugs in the early 90s. And unfortunately, my mother passed away because she was the victim of this pharmacist. Now, do I believe in the death penalty? No. I don't believe that the state should have that power. Do I believe in self-defense? Yes. Do I think that the government should keep people like myself from enacting vigilante justice against people like Robert Courtney? Absolutely. So I do think that there would be, without some form of restraint in civil society, that there would be people who would enact vigilante justice. I think that anarchists revel and delight in the idea of vigilante justice. There's nothing they would love more than to see people, than to see the mob, the outraged mob go and kill, you know, maybe George W. Bush or any other person that they seem to feel is the dictator of the month, maybe myself included. I've certainly been violently threatened by a lot of people who call themselves anarcho-capitalists.
Have?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually had.
Who?
So a perfect example would have been when I gave a speech at Porkfest, for example. I like to debunk things like 9/11 conspiracies and chemtrails and vaccines as part of a matter of course. But I was almost physically assaulted when I walked off the stage because someone was so offended at this anarchist gathering. And that person had to be physically restrained from attacking me. So, and I get these kinds of threats regularly, Thomas, because that to me just shows that I really must be onto something, because if you can't stand your ideas up to scrutiny, if you cannot stand, if you can't get without being emotional, then I think that there's probably something wrong with your beliefs. And so,
okay, but I mean, but look, there are crazy people,
of course,
everywhere,
fine,
you know, and it's not
fine. And I totally accept that. And I'm not going to try and paint with a broad brush here. I have lots of anarcho-capitalists who I take great inspiration from, and certainly you are one of them. Bob Murphy is one of them. But again, I'm more inspired by the Nozickian state. And I happen to think that the problem with anarchism is that it doesn't account for the evil nature of man, that there is...
All right, hold on. All right. Okay, now I have to get some time here. Like, I mean, not because I need to dominate the guest or anything, but I do have a point of view to represent here, and my normal friendly posture is to let the guest talk forever, but in this case, I do need to jump in.
Go ahead.
All right, there's just some. I mean, I jotted down so many things, and each one of them is like a whole episode here. All right, so you're talking about we need the government to enforce individual rights. Okay, I mean, I can at least understand that point of view. I just feel like when I look at the system of the United States right now, I don't feel like the system of law enforcement and courts is primarily aimed at the enforcement of individual rights. I think it's aimed at putting people in cages for victimless crimes. It's aimed at punishing people for not paying enough taxes. It's aimed at trying to get more revenue for the government. I mean, when I look at the corruption of the police, the total ineffectiveness of the police, by the way. I mean, how many murders do they actually solve and then they put the guy away? What is it, 3%? I mean, if anarchy were that bad, that would be an argument against anarchy. I can't imagine private enforcers possibly being as bad as this. And by the way, I still feel like I let you get away with the why isn't there a natural right to food? I still feel like I haven't got a good answer to that. But put that in the back of your minds. Put that in the back of your mind. In terms of mobs, I don't know any anarcho-capitalist who favors that. The state is the one that eggs on the mobs to get what it wants. The state wants mob rule because guess who gets to come in and restore order? Well, it's the state. Now, in terms of the non-aggression principle being like a just like a social contract, it's not in this sense. The social contract is an agreement in which I allegedly consented. I mean, to add insult to injury, they claim that I consented to have my property taken away, to be drafted into the wars and whatever, because I haven't left. I mean, what kind of principle is that? There's no other part of our lives in which we would ever vindicate a principle like that. Because you happen to be standing there and you haven't left. Now, if you're standing on private property, that's one thing.
There we go.
You
that's
do
what
abide
I was gonna
by
say.
Their rules. But does the government own the entire country? That's a tyrannical principle.
I mean,
no, that's where
they do have eminent domain, and
okay, which
that
okay, but that's just a matter of positive fact.
Sure.
Is that justifiable? Eminent domain comes from the monarchical view that the king owns the whole realm and he's just letting you use it.
Yeah, not
is that a principle we want to adopt?
No, not the federal government, but I think that we probably, if we adopted a more decentralized approach to something like eminent domain, like maybe certain states.
So a more decentralized approach to me saying, I think we have more numbers than you do, and we think we can put your property to better use than you are. You're okay with that?
No, there should be, again, we need checks on democracy. This is why the founders created this adversarial system. So I would say that if you were to allow the states to decide, that some states would do it and some states wouldn't. Just like you say.
I would rather have the states decide, yes, because right. Then there'd be a greater chance of some free states, freer states.
That's correct. And so, again, I would like to give the states the opportunity to experiment with that. And some states would do it and some states wouldn't. But no, I don't think that a one-size-fits-all eminent domain of the federal government across everything is probably in our best interest. But I do think that the federal government needs to have supremacy in certain items, not in all items. That the supremacy clause, to me, denotes that the federal government has supremacy only in those powers which are specifically delineated to the federal government, and then all other rights belong to the states and there to the people. But I think it's a beautiful system, Tom. I mean, of course it doesn't work, but again, just like you said, there isn't going to be any one-size-fits-all system. And to be honest, I mean, come on, Tom, you and I, you know that we both agree on like not maybe 90% of the issues.
I know we do. We do. And I was gonna talk about Bernie Sanders because I can't stand him. But we get onto this. Now, where do you stand on the roads question?
Oh, I'm for decentralization again.
Okay. Fair enough, but I don't want to let you get away with decentralization because I've used that as a cop out sometimes too.
Okay.
I want to know what is your preferred system. I mean, do you favor a system that involves any coercive taxation whatsoever for the funding of roads? I just want to know.
No, and here's
why. Okay, but then why couldn't the leftists come back at you and say, well, look, Austin Peterson, you're all worried about what would happen without government involvement in the legal system, that people wouldn't have representation and they would be screwed. Well, without government involvement in roads, people would build roads around people's houses and then people would be, they wouldn't give them access rights to the road, they'd be stuck in their house forever. We could oppress people by just building roads, so we need government for roads. You see how when you give them an inch, they're going to take a mile?
Oh, totally, but it's the same with anarchy. If you give anarchists an inch, they're going to take a mile too. But here's the thing. When it comes to there's a market function for roads. Okay, there's no market function for a laser space asteroid defense system. Okay, there are certain things for which the market does well, and there are certain things which the market doesn't do well. There's no reason.
But who's going to decide that? Austin Peterson?
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, like, I'd love to crowdfund a space cannon to destroy asteroids. I don't know how much people would want to invest in it. Maybe they would like to invest in it.
Maybe they would. Every single thing I hear that where it's said that only the government can fund it because it would be too expensive, mm-hmm. there are always examples of private industry funding every single thing. Or only the government can help people overseas when there are natural disasters. But
only the government can enforce a monopoly on the definition of private property. I truly do believe that. It doesn't matter what the government is. It doesn't matter if the government is the government down the street or the federal government itself. But there should be one single unified definition of private property, and there should be one single unified definition of certain natural rights that should be codified. I mean,
okay, but we don't have that now.
Do you think that the anti-federalists were wrong in writing the Bill of Rights and codifying it and working within the system and saying if we were going to have, you know, minarchists understand that the government is inevitable. You know, the Federalists, listen, like, I love to see the anarchists cry out for anarchy so that we can have people like George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton having private nuclear weapons. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't we all love to see the neocons passing around our beautiful libertarian women back and forth because they don't believe in the non-aggression principle? See, the problem.
So in other words, you really think that on the market it is impossible to provide security service without government, it would be rapists everywhere. I mean, I don't understand why you have such confidence in the market and 99% of things, but not here.
There are rapists everywhere. There are people who, like you saw in Baltimore, who are just simply waiting for their opportunity to destroy private property. And of course, there were the biker gangs down there in Texas who they needed some killing right away because they were destroying other people's private property and they were violating the non-aggression principle. So would I like to see more private citizens taking up their self-defense in their hometowns? Absolutely. Do I think that if you incentivize them to do so and give them the ability to protect themselves, they'll do so? Absolutely. But rights, and this is the quote that really pissed everybody off, rights are guarantees, something that must be provided. And that is not a quote from me, Tom, and your anarchist followers really need to check themselves before they wreck themselves, because that was a direct quote from one Mr. Senior Judge Andrew Napolitano. That was his direct quote, and that was the number one thing that was disagreed with me. They said, how dare you say rights are guarantees? Absolutely. If you say something is a right, it is a guarantee. It's something that must be provided.
I can understand a sense in which that phrase could make sense. That if we're talking about from the point of view of the government, if the government has, for example, the First Amendment, that is supposed to be a guarantee to you that the government won't interfere with it.
Correct.
But it's not. But of course, just simply articulating rights can't possibly be a physical guarantee that they won't be interfered with by other parties.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And I think that's what people were objecting to.
Sure. Oh, absolutely, Tom. But again, it comes down to a misunderstanding. And I think that there is maybe there's a belief that perhaps I'm being malicious. And a lot of times I do play devil's advocate simply because I'd like to see how I would like to test our ideas up to public scrutiny. I mean, libertarians, you were talking about national defense and security. Do I think there's a market for security? Absolutely. Would I like to see more private security? Absolutely. And you know what? Here's a problem that we have in our movement, Tom, when it comes to national security. I'll just tell the story very briefly. But I was speaking to a group of YALers, the Young Americans for Liberty group, talking about the Boston bombing back when we thought it was foreign nationals who had attacked us. And I said, pop quiz, anarcho hot shots. You've just had the Boston bombers just blew up your marathon. Which would you rather have by show of hands? You can send in SEAL Team 6, these are the professional forces, or you can hire Blackwater mercenaries. And it was a nearly even split of those young libertarians who thought that the market solution, the Blackwater solution, would have been superior, and the other half who would have rather trusted the state's security forces to handle what was believed to be a state problem. Now, you know, Bill Buckley, I don't agree with his argument, you know, during the Cold War that we need to create an enormous Leviathan superstate in order to create an enormous, you know, to fight an enormous Leviathan superstate. But you need options, Tom, and when it comes to national security. You know, another example, North Korea, for example, they point the nuke at California. I had an anarchist say that we have to wait until that nuke comes off the launch pad.
Okay, but I could say, I've had minarchists say crazy things too.
Okay, sure. But I mean, again, there's no real defense in the non-aggression principle. There's no real allocation for defense because there's no definition of what is aggression. And so, unfortunately, it behooves us to sit down and say, what is aggression? What is the best way to handle it? And sometimes I think that might be a state solution, and sometimes it might not be a state solution. I would prefer to go with a non-state solution always as the matter of default. But that if natural rights are being destroyed, then we do have an obligation societally to defend life,
all right,
liberty, and property.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So many things to do. All right. There's no aggression. There's no definition of aggression.
Right.
Now, by the way, we blasted past that time frame that I mentioned earlier. Like, that's not even, I don't know what your plans are for today, but I'm just going to keep.
I thought I was going to be a dope. I think people thought I was some dope, that I was just some idiot producer or something like that. But I actually do my homework, guys.
No. Look, I've not said any disparaging things about Austin Peterson. But but let me review a few things at once, and then you can take them one at a time. First of all, I agree that it would be helpful to have a definition of aggression that's accepted by everybody. Of course. But whether or not you have a government, that problem still exists. Because today, I don't think the U.S. government has a correct understanding of what aggression is. I don't think the U.S. government has a correct understanding of what rights are. Obviously. I mean, the drug war makes that obvious. The way they police makes that obvious. The way they spy on people makes that obvious. The way they take people's property makes that obvious. They have no idea what rights are. So the idea that, well, government will solve this problem because it'll give us a single standard that we can all agree to is just faulty in practice. Why wouldn't they have an interest in defining these things in a way that benefits themselves? What reason would they have for giving us a sensible definition of any of these things? They've never given us a good definition of those. They don't,
and that's why we have to take it over, which is why I want to ask you. Do you support Rand Paul?
Oh, all right. Well, No. I already talked about Rand Paul in another episode. If we talk about Rand Paul, I have two more interviews to do today, and I'm going to have to cancel them both. And I've had to kill to get these interviews. So if you want to talk about Rand Paul, maybe we could do an episode on that.
For
the time being, I want to just stick to this. So first of all, what you're saying the state ought to do or needs to do, it isn't doing. It has never done. Secondly, the whole let's elect somebody and then we'll be able to cut through all the layers of vested interests and bureaucracy that exist, whose lives depend on nothing changing, whose livelihoods depend on nothing changing, is absolutely a fantasy beyond any wild speculation of any anarchist who ever lived.
You're so full of it on this one, Tom, and I'll tell you why.
Let's hear it.
because guess who's running for president? Adam Kokesh. And guess what Adam Kokesh's idea of how things should be done is? Adam Kokesh wants to run for president for the single purpose of abolishing the federal government by fiat. He wants to be an anarchist dictator. And so what you have just described, you said no one wants to do it. You need to read Adam Kokesh's latest book.
Okay, that's true. But I'm sure Adam would be the first to admit that he's a rather small minority and that he has
all of the
universe stacked against him. Okay. So if your answer to me is Adam Kokesh, I will concede to you that point. But I still feel like the strength of my argument is quite powerful. Secondly, I'm not totally sure I accept the Rummel estimates for deaths in the 20th century. You know, the R.J. Rummel death by government estimates of how many people died. I mean, I've heard some experts say that he vastly overstates the number of people killed in China and other places. But okay, let's whatever. I mean, we know it's still a huge number of people killed in the 20th century. I mean, it's at least 100 million, and that's what he estimates even abstracting from the wars. Now, this was all carried out by government. This is an institution that we're told, well, but oh, gosh, we need this thing for security. We need it to define private property. We need this and that. I mean, I don't see how anarcho-capitalism could possibly be any worse than a system like that that has never – I mean, give me an example of a lasting regime that gave you minarchism. And that didn't give you this. I don't see. So I mean, to say that, well, you know, you're proposing this untested system.
Well,
okay, maybe mine is somewhat untested. Yours is totally tested and totally a disaster.
Mm, No, not really. I mean, like, you know, even we actually do have natural rights protected in some sense in this country. I mean, we are the only one that has a constitution that protects our free speech rights. Of course, there were many systems in the past. There was Carolinian law. The European superstate, the Holy Roman Empire, which is not, you know, perfectly libertarian, but it was somewhat monarchist, and it did practice a sort of non-interventionist foreign policy. They were very interventionist in foreign policy, but when it came to domestic policy, they were very laissez-faire. And so if you think about it, that's actually the policy, that's actually the belief of many modern neocons. And it was working at Fox News and getting up front and personal in the faces of people like Donald Rumsfeld and John Bolton, who call themselves libertarians, that I was actually forced to reconsider some of my understandings. Because if some people who call themselves neoconservatives identify as libertarians, I had to wonder for myself, then in what way do they define it as such? And these are people who take somewhat of a realist view of foreign policy, meaning that, you know, whether it's space invaders or whether it's the government of China, that we may be facing threats from external threats, but that the government at home should be one of laissez-faire and protecting individual liberties. And sometimes that does mean displaying some form of aggression overseas or outside of the sphere of the planet Earth if we were to ever be attacked in such a way. And that, unfortunately, it would require a marshaling of resources for us to provide for that common defense. Any citizen who can do so individually may contract with other individuals in order to form a group, a nation state, in order to marshal those resources for the defense of life, liberty, and property. And so when you say, has there been any state that has done it? Yes, I would say that there have been better examples of others. There was the hoplite farmers from Greek history. They paid no taxes. They did, of course, have a bit of a foreign policy that was not libertarian. But again, nothing's going to be perfect. Just like you say, I know there was Icelandic Godor was another good example of very decentralized power. There were warlords, but there was a lot of individual sovereignty. So, you know, yes, I could pull out lots of examples for you of minarchist systems that have worked better than most, but the one that I think that has been the best at protecting individual rights has been the American government, and has, and despite the fact that it has destroyed many of our liberties that were instilled since our founding, that we should be fighting to restore as much as we can, such as the abolition of the income tax, the pro-democracy 17th Amendment. You know, I've read your books, Tom. I've read all your books. So I know what issues you care about here. And I do think that the United States government, while it is certainly a great evil in the world, it is not the greatest evil. And that if you actually read read our enemies, read John Bolton, read what's his name? Donald Rumsfeld. You know, Donald Rumsfeld was buddies with Milton Friedman. You know, he believes in limited government at home, but that the limited government at home can only be protected by muscular defense abroad. I think it creeps into militarism, and that's when it becomes a problem. And then, of course, when these people do take power, that they become corrupted, because as Lord Acton said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Our job, Tom, should be to limit their ambitions. And the only way that we can limit these neocons' ambitions is by creating a system where their ambitions are, where their unbridled ambitions are bridled, so that we don't allow the private ownership of nuclear weapons from people such as Hillary Clinton.
Okay, there's an awful lot we can talk about that. The nuclear weapons thing is, I'll admit, that is a tricky one. I've heard the way it's been dealt with by some people who are anarchists, and I have to say I'm not totally satisfied with it. I'll be honest with you about that. And incidentally, I lean in this direction. I mean, I identify myself as being a Rothbardian, but I don't claim that I have all the answers. And part of that is the humility that comes from believing in society and the market, that if I could anticipate what every single entrepreneur would do, then, you know, my life would be a lot more prosperous than it is now. You know, yeah. So I can't know all the answers. But of course, I think some anarchists think that's a really satisfying reply, but to anybody other than a really committed, knowledgeable libertarian, that is the most deeply unsatisfying reply that you could possibly give. Well, I don't know how it would all work out, but somehow things would be taken care of is not a good answer. I mean, ultimately, in a way, you do have to fall back on that in the sense that you and I couldn't have anticipated how the industry of consumer credit would have worked itself out without seeing it happen. But still, it's very unsatisfying to say to people, well, somehow consumer credit will emerge. I mean, it'd be nice to at least try to theorize about where it would come from.
Right.
All right, two more things I want to ask you.
Sure.
The first is, do you believe that a group of people getting together can authorize an institution to exercise powers that they themselves individually would not be allowed to exercise, morally or legally? And secondly, I want to talk about, briefly anyway, the subject of secession. So I'll form that question after you deal with the first one.
Sure. So can a group of people, yes, as long as they consent to it, meaning that if they form a group and they all agree to those rules that say, let's call it a contract and say that they all agree to it, then yes, we can say, okay, I'm going to give up voluntarily a portion of my liberty to act in such a manner, meaning to perhaps enact vigilante justice on my neighbor if their pond is leaking onto my property. And I will give power to a representative of myself who I have elected to speak for me to adjudicate these matters. So yes, I think people can do that. They can give up power voluntarily. And we do that every day. And so yes, I do think that a collection of individuals can do that as long as they are fully informed of the processes through which that those matters will be adjudicated.
All right. Let me ask you, because I mean, of course, I could say that can they decide for everybody in a society, even if the other people aren't on board for it?
But yes,
but
yes,
that's a
yes.
Okay.
Yes, to an extent.
All right.
Absolutely.
So, all right. So that's part of your. All right. Now, somewhat related to that, I mean, we still need to say something about taxation, because
sure.
If the idea of government.
Why are we not talking about this? I mean, this is the number one thing. I mean, I have an article on the libertarianrepublic.com. I keep trying to point these anarchists to it. And when I talk about my minarchist utopia, there are ways to fund public services that don't require coercion.
You know, okay, good. All right, well, when we get off, email me the link and I'll put it on the show notes page. And remember, everybody, tomwoods.com/414. I'll link to anything Austin wants and, of course, anything I want. You know, it's my show, but I'll link to anything you want on there of yours. But go ahead.
Okay, sure. So the best example, I think the best way to get revenue out of these people is to have a lottery. The founding fathers used a lottery. George Washington signed lots of lottery tickets, and that was a great way for them to fund public infrastructure.
Okay, all right, what else?
I'm trying to pull it up right now so I can remember all the different ways. A sales tax.
Hold on. I mean, now this would be, if you were one of my traditional guests, we would lovingly describe all the different ways that these things can be done without, but you're not a traditional guest.
Okay.
So instead of that, let's focus on areas of disagreement. You obviously do think that at root, the government does have some right of taxation.
Sure.
So let me ask you, how do you deal, and maybe you could concede that this is at least a difficulty for your position, if you're saying that one of the values of having a centralized system that will deal with, resolving disputes and defining property and defining aggression and all that, is that you have this common definition and everybody can organize his life according to it and we can adjudicate disputes according to it. Well, two problems come from this. Number one, how do they define property in such a way that property is yours as long as the government doesn't want it in the form of eminent domain or taxation? I mean, then how is that not a completely non-arbitrary definition of property? And then secondly, what once you grant them this, what other than what they think they can get away with could possibly limit the amount they're going to tax? And don't tell me that Rand Paul is running for president, because I will bet you right now, Rand Paul or no Rand Paul, 20 years from now, that the tax rates will be pretty much where they are now. I will absolutely guarantee you that. I'll shake your hand on it right now. We're recording this, what is it today? May 28th, 2015. 2035, if one of us isn't dead, let's revisit this and see where the tax rates are. It's not going to change.
Maybe I'm just optimistic because I'm still young and beautiful, Tom, so I look forward to the future with the idea.
Well, young anyway. All right.
So I just feel like that there is a chance in the future that we could build a more libertarian republic, that the idea is that we could have a lower tax rate. You know, people thought that nothing.
But why would they want to do it?
Well, why did Ronald Reagan want to cut taxes as soon as he got into office?
But on net, did he really?
No, of course not. But
so in other words, the guy who most articulated libertarian principles in the second half of the 20th century, even he failed at it.
And
now you have an even bigger entitlement problem. You have all these other reasons to tax. You got an unending war. What possible way are they ever going to do it? They're going to read books that we write? I mean, what possible reason? So, I mean, will you at least concede that when this monopoly institution has a monopoly on determining what the tax rates are, that that could be a problem?
Sure.
Will you concede that to me?
Yes, absolutely. It's a problem. But again, there's problems in an anarchist utopia. The idea is that...
Wait, hold on a minute. I have to stop you there. I personally have never said that in the absence of a state, you'd have utopia. And I know you've never said that with minarchy, there would be utopia. So let's throw the word utopia out.
Yeah, because utopia defined literally actually means no place. And so when you're talking about taxation, you had two questions there. One was the tax rate, and I'm forgetting the first one. But six ways to fund public services in a libertarian republic. Of course, there are voluntary taxes. People could donate to a pool. There certainly were voluntary associations before we had the income tax. People pooled their resources in order to pay for things like fire and police services. So that could be reinstituted if people were incentivized to do that, but of course they're not incentivized under the current system, which you and I see, I think, rightfully as tyrannical.
Look, I'm going to agree with everything that you're saying. I mean, that for things that we need in common, especially now with the internet and all different ways to get people all over the country contributing to something, mm-hmm. in your town.
Right. Well, here's the problem.
It'd be amazing.
This is the time when I have to praise the one person that I despise the most. But, you know, having read Hamilton's Curse, but Alexander Hamilton, you know, the mercantilist idea was that in order for us to have free trade, that there had to be some form of coercion to protect us from negative actors. I mean, have you ever had anything, Tom, where we were having a nice day, you were having a nice party, and then somebody has to come in and screw it up? You know, I sure have. And so in order for us to engage in mutual trade, free trade, there does need to be some sort of a protection. I would prefer private protection firms to engage in the type of coercion that's necessary, say, in the Strait of Hormuz, where Iranian belligerents would just love to stem the flow of oil and stem the flow of free trade. And while I don't consider myself a Hamiltonian mercantilist, it's very hard to argue with the neoconservatives on this point about whether or not the corporations who already are being coerced to pay taxes for this military should not benefit from it on the right of protection through these dangerous straits in the world where people do not respect the individual natural rights of man. So again, I'm not a Hamiltonian mercantilist, but these are the arguments that neoconservatives make, and we have to have better arguments for addressing them other than saying, we'll just, you know, put a few guys in Uzis on the back of the oil companies, let them pay for their own private security. Okay, yeah, that's great, you know, and that does sound good in theory and something I definitely would advocate for. But again, it doesn't seem to mesh with the long march of history and the state of war of nations. I mean, so again, somebody always comes in and screws up your nice little free trade zone. It's just how it is. So you have to have a system that accounts for bad actors. And the problem with anarchy is that it allows everyone to just be a bad actor, screwing up everyone else's day. For example, tolls.
But I feel like minarchy doesn't account for bad actors because the bad actors are naturally attracted to a system like this.
Agreed.
And they exercise. I mean, look, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Not only do they have a monopoly on force, but they have a monopoly on, and here's the key thing, legitimacy in the eyes of the public. If I'm just some guy, some schmo running around town causing problems, nobody in his right mind is going to be persuaded if I suddenly tell everybody, oh, by the way, you all owe me a third of your income. But if they spend 12 years in a government indoctrination factory being told that being expropriated is for their own good and wise public servants are going to put that money to the common good, protecting trade routes and providing playgrounds, they're going to go for it. And that's the problem that the minarchist faces.
No, I used to think that, like, you know, I mean, here's the thing. This is actually a Christopher Hitchens quote. You know, I think it's actually possible to hold the belief that while no one knows how to live your life better for you than you do, that it's simultaneously impossible to bring about a society based on that idea because of the bad actor thing. So the idea is, yes, obviously bad people will go into the minarchist state. You know, here's an example that I love to discuss, and this is where I did my, this is how this all started, because in the show Game of Thrones, I don't know if you're a follower of that.
I don't actually watch it, sorry.
Your listeners probably do, and they're probably familiar with the Night's Watch, which is to me an allegory of the Night Watchman state. And all of the different kingdoms of Westeros, with, which are at war with one another, all give voluntarily to members of their society to go and stand on the wall. And the wall is where all the dangerous things try and come over and destroy the kingdoms of man. And the purpose of the Night's Watch is to stand on the wall and to play the role of Night Watchman. The idea, and the problem is that there are power struggles on the wall. There are would-be tyrants and warlords, but the idea is they actually take an oath saying that they will stay out of the politics of man. But in reality, all of the kingdoms of man are still at war with one another. We are at war with one another. John Nash, who unfortunately passed away, his understandings of game theory, I think, to me, are correct, that we are sort of playing against one another and trying to maximize our potential. That's sort of how the economy works. And he called his game theory, you know, F you, buddy, right? So the idea is that, you know, it makes sense always to betray. And knowing this, knowing that it makes sense always to betray our fellow man, that there are people like the sociopaths that you discuss, the ones who want to work in government, who are always trying to use this game theory negatively against each other. It's not people like you and me who are engaging in free market capitalism who are trying to exchange mutual benefit. That's a relatively new phenomenon in the world, Tom. And we all benefit from the largesse that capitalism gives us. But that the Night Watchman state is, their goal is to provide us protection against the wildlings and the White Walkers. That the evil of man that exists should never be allowed to come near the wall, and that we all must, either voluntarily or otherwise, provide some sort of a subsistence to that defense of our natural rights.
Well, Austin, I think in light of how long we've gone, I think I am actually going to call it quits for today. Just given that I do believe this is a record for the, now, last week I had an episode where it was just me talking, but I'm allowed to talk as long as I want, that I think was slightly longer than this. I was actually reproducing I was talking about classical liberalism in my kid's school. The 11th grade has a great ideas class, and every year they invite me for the unit on classical liberalism to explain what classical liberalism is and who the main thinkers were, and I always enjoy that, and people are saying, you dolt, why don't you record that and use it on your show? So I thought, yeah, I'm kind of lazy. I'd like to get a free episode out of this. So I did that. I think that one might be slightly longer. But basically, other than that, I think we've set the record. So let me see. What I'm going to do on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/414, is after we finish talking, I'm going to have you send me links to anything you'd like to put up there. I'll put up your five anarchist reasons thing. I'm going to put up Larkin Rose's response. He has a video response to you. And then any other articles that you would like to go up there, of course, we'll have a generic link to the libertarianrepublic.com. And it's not libertarianrepublic.com. It's thelibertarianrepublic.com. And then I'm going to put a few related episodes up here. I'll put episodes I did with Bob Murphy on private defense and private law for people who are interested. Well, Austin, I told you 20 to 25 minutes. You can't trust me. Maybe we need some central authority that will define time better than I obviously am able to do. But
Tom, I'm a great fan of yours, and I was honored to be invited on the show today. You've been inspiring me for years. Please continue doing what you do.
Well, you're very kind to say that, and you're a good sport to be on with me for so long, and to take, you know, I really wasn't even planning to have the conversation go in this particular direction. I had other controversial issues I wanted to bring up with you, but maybe that'll be an excuse to talk again in the future.
Sounds good, Tom. Call me anytime, and have a great day. Keep fighting the good fight.
Thanks a lot. All right, everybody, I release a new episode Monday through Friday, so make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. You'll find the links conveniently available at tomwoods.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.